Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Anoush.
And I'm Stephen.
And this is the New Statesman podcast.
Fresh from Conservative Party conference, we talk about...
what Stephen learned about the Conservative Party.
Anoush tells me about Labour's plans to scrap universal credit.
And you ask us, will the next election be about Brexit? So I'm joined by Stephen and comfortably with two mic guards in between us because he has got the infamous conference cold after coming back from Conservative Party conference on the train from Manchester today. Stephen, how are you feeling?
I actually feel fine. I actually feel great, to be honest, which I've kept saying.
You sound like Macy Gray.
Yeah, I kept saying, I'm on the phone and they're like, you sound terrible. I was like, I feel great. I don't understand why people think I... But yeah, so fortunately, the only thing of me which seems to have negative after effects is my throat and nose. But it was odd because I, in many ways, found this the most useful Conservative Party conference I've ever been to because the effect of the suspension being undone is, I think, every lobbyist who didn't want to go basically went, right, that's my excuse, I'm going to take it, which meant then... a lot of the time at Tory Party conference, I feel like you don't have much of a sense of what the activists feel like, and it's so hard to talk to any activists, which, to me at least, is the useful thing about conference season, right, is ultimately I can speak to MPs and staffers pretty easily in Westminster, and I can go home at the end of the evening.
Mm.
The value of conference is getting to find out how the grassroots rank and file of our political parties feels about things. And a lot of the time, and I think this is just true of whoever the governing party is,
yeah.
But a lot of the time when you're at the governing party's conference, you spend a lot of time being like, oh no, you work for, you know, Dong Energy. That's a real
is that
company.
One of our ads?
Yeah, some lobbyist or something. And obviously, you know, no shade to lobbyists, many of whom listen to this podcast, but I don't, their opinion does not tell me what the Conservative rank and file thinks because most of them aren't the Conservative rank and file. Whereas this was quite useful in the... There weren't more members than usual, but there were more members per head than usual, and it was easier to get a sense of what the feeling of it was. And obviously it was quite upbeat. Well, obviously last year all of the energy was around, you know, huge queues for Jacob Rees-Mogg, huge queues for Boris Johnson. That, of course, hasn't changed, but that's moved from the fringe of the conference to its heart. And I think, so John has written, a very well-written piece about what his impressions of the conference were, which I enjoyed, but I must admit, his impression, which is that it didn't feel like this was a party which absorbed and it was on the brink of losing power, was very much not my impression. There were lots of people who were very much like, it's brilliant, I've got the party I want, but every day, I don't think I went more than an hour, and admittedly, I think I'm probably one of the most prominent journalists to have gone, okay, well, this may work in small towns, but there's this thing called the South of England, and there's this thing called the Liberal Democrats, and this thing called the SNP, so it's risky. So maybe I slightly ended up with a disproportionate thing. But I felt, although it's a minority of the party, at every level, every hour I would speak to, you know, whether it was a councillor or an activist or an MP or a minister or a special advisor who would say, I don't think this can possibly work. I don't believe, someone said to me, they were just like, I just don't believe that we will be able to gain enough in small towns to make up for what is happening to our vote in London and it's happening to our vote in the South. And it was interesting how there, although there is, you know, a huge amount of joy and, you know, they're basically just having their stomachs tickled in the conference centre.
Yeah.
I do think there is an ambient awareness that there is, you know, a hefty downsize electoral risk. Obviously, the unnerving thing is there is not, among the activist base, any kind of awareness of the downside, the kind of downside risk, and you're like, what if, you know, the worst projections of no deal are right? What does that do to your party?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the odd thing about this conference from a coverage perspective, I kind of struggled with it for the same reason I struggled with Labour last year.
Mm.
With Labour last year, day one, you're like, this is a very well-run conference based around their tactical analysis, and what they need to do better than 2017 is improve their performance in Leave voting small towns. And everything Labour did in 2018's conference was calibrated around that. But once you'd said it on day one, there was not an awful lot left to analyse about their political strategy, which is nice in a way, and it frees you up to just write about policy. As with that conference last year, I wrote quite a lot about the actual sort of policy stuff coming through. But it also means that you kind of have this slight weirdness of like, what is the conference feels like it lacks sort of momentum in an old way, because weirdly, precisely because of the momentum it was doing, I think probably quite a good job of conveying from the outside.
No one's really interested in someone's outlook who wasn't actually there. But I was covering other stories in London, mainly looking at homelessness over the time that you were at Conservative Party conference. So I was following it like I probably would have followed the conference as a regular sort of news consumer. And the main story that seemed to overarch and overshadow most of the conference were these allegations against Boris Johnson by the columnist in the Sunday Times, and the follow-up questions that journalists were asking him, and also his sort of, you know, representatives on planet Earth, and how they were sort of saying the wrong thing or saying the right thing but sounding disloyal. And that, to me, seemed to colour quite a lot of the sort of, I mean, it sounds cynical and maybe a bit glib, but the sort of air war of the conference, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And it is, I mean, I think it's actually always useful to get a sense, because this thing, you always have this weird thing where kind of at every conference, MPs go up to journalists and go, how do you think it's going? And you're kind of like, well, your guess is as good as mine, because there's this thing called the 6 and the 10, which I never get time to watch at conference. And yeah, like...
Yeah, the 6 and the 10 are the key times where you're just, like, eating the leftover canapes.
Yeah. arriving at a restaurant booking where you're like, I know that I've said 6, and I know that I phoned 3 times to change the number to 7, and then to 8, and then back to 7. But actually, it's now 8 again. I'm really sorry, could we have another chair?
I mean, did that feel like it was a story there? Did it feel like it was derailing?
So it's interesting, because the extent to which that came up, speaking to activists, the thing lots of them said was, wow, there are no women here. Now, obviously, there are never as many women at Conservative Party conference as men.
In any party?
In any party. Well, this is actually a really interesting thing about the two surges that we've seen. In the Lib Dem surge meant they went from being a 50-50 party to a 60-30 party, which is the normal in heavy inverted commas.
60 men.
Yeah, the normal demographic pattern for a political party. Labour's surge had the reverse option. They went from having the normal 60-30, you know, disproportionate representation of men in their rank and file to 50-50, which is obviously still a... Actually, it's an interesting question. Is it a slight... I was going to say it's obviously still a slight over-representation, because women are more than 50% of the population. Mm. But then I think, actually, in terms of Labour voters, because of when you control for age, are women a disproportionate... You know, is that more than you would expect? I don't know.
But a better gender balance.
But a better gender balance. And it's interesting that those two surges have the reverse effect on their party's rank and file. And so lots of people kind of would speculate it to me, is this women activists voting with their feet? Which it could be. Obviously, that is the simplest explanation. I'm a bit leery of it, for the basic reason that party memberships are so unrepresentative of their voters.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, like, the example, of course, in order to the most fun, is Corbyn's electoral successes in 2017 versus Corbyn's areas of I mean, strength. It kind of understates it, because he obviously won in the landslide, so he had very few areas of non-strength, as it were, in the 2016 leadership election. But essentially, the worst Corbyn did relative to his own performance in 2016 in the leadership election, the better he did in the leadership election in the relative region, right? Like,
his weakest
area in the leadership election in both times was London and Scotland. Where did he gain the most votes? London. Where did he gain seats against expectations? Scotland. Yeah, the type of person who joins a political party tends to have so much more in common with other people who join a political party in terms of their demographic profile, obviously not in terms of their attitudinal profile. I think in some ways I'm always a bit dubious about kind of going, so the explanation which makes sense for the real world probably also makes sense for the party membership.
Yeah.
Another good example with Labour is the Labour membership is overwhelmingly white. The Labour vote is much more ethnically diverse. And when you think about the polls and indeed the Euros, the Labour vote now must be even more ethnically diverse. Yeah, the average Labour voter is getting more ethnic, as it were, just because ethnic minority voters are more loyal to Labour.
Mm.
So I don't know if it was just the more of the lobbyists were women, and it's just that means that you're like, oh wow, there are really no women here. Or if it is, because obviously it could simply be the simplest explanation, which is women voting with their feet because of their concerns about Boris Johnson. I feel like, in an odd way, the groping story is, yeah, I mean, I start from the presumption that I don't think people make up fake accusations on the whole.
Mm.
So I start from the presumption that it's probably true. But I kind of think that the perception is that Boris Johnson is a bit sleazy anyway.
Yeah.
And if you dislike him, and he's a player if you like him. Whereas
yeah.
I think the Arcuri thing, where there are allegations about effectively government spending at City Hall, is potentially more damaging because the perception of corruption is a new accusation.
Mm. And he was referred to the police, which sounds, you know, a lot more official.
Yeah, although it will complete our transition post-Brexit into kind of like towards Italy if we have a situation in which a strong man is comfortably re-elected while being investigated for corruption. Yeah, well maybe I keep trying to work out is Boris's electoral model. I actually don't think Trump is a very good model. I think it feels to me far closer to Berlusconi, this kind of, oh, I'm not of the establishment. I'm anti-system, but obviously of the mainstream right.
Mm-hmm.
Or more like Netanyahu, where again, it's those elites, you know, those terrible Tel Aviv intellectuals, you know, they don't understand it like I do. I am the real people. And again, yeah, this kind of wafts of corruption, which,
mm.
you know, until relatively recently, did not seem to be a particular barrier to successful re-elections. So maybe that is simply, you know, about how we complete the look.
Mm. the full set.
Yeah.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
And the question we've been asked this week is, last time the conventional wisdom was that it would be a Brexit election. Once again, the conventional wisdom is it will be a Brexit election. Why will it or won't, you know, essentially. I've slightly mangled that question because...
Will the next election... We've taken for granted that the next election will be about Brexit, but will that be the main driver of people's votes?
Yeah,
it's a good question because that is what happened in the last election. A lot of the focus of the reporting, as well as the interviewing, you know, the radio interviews and everything, was all about Brexit. But actually, after the result came out and it was so unexpected and most of the polls hadn't predicted such a result, there was a lot of talk about what people were actually voting on, and that tended to be, you know, the fact of schools cuts in certain areas, the ivory trade ban disappearing from the manifesto. Is that what happened? Another one. And fox hunting as well on the Conservative manifesto.
And the dementia tax.
The dementia tax as well. Although that was covered during the campaign, whereas I think some of the other stuff kind of came out afterwards.
Yeah.
In terms of what people were searching and what was going viral online.
Yeah, and what people listed as reasons to change their vote in Bez. The really fascinating thing actually about the last election now is all of the evidence, both from at the time and from what the British Electoral Survey stuff shows, is that the movement of Remainers to Labour was not primarily about stopping Brexit.
Mm.
However, in many ways, right, it's a bit like if someone says, I always knew I would break up with so-and-so. I always knew it was a doomed relationship. in a way, it doesn't matter if it's true, because if someone believes that to be true, the relationship is dead anyway, right? Yeah. And even though the evidential basis for the claim that, you know, we hear a lot from listeners and readers that they voted Labour to stop Brexit, and in some cases with people who email me regularly, I could, if I were feeling sufficiently passive-aggressive, email them back with things they said at the time to indicate that actually, no, Brexit was not what they were thinking about at the time.
Yeah.
But people believe Brexit was what they were thinking about at the time last time, and they were sold something they didn't buy. It's not true, but they believe it to be true, which is ultimately
the same thing,
yeah, in terms of voter behaviour. Now, I think one of the reasons why the last election wasn't a Brexit election is the two major parties had, not the same Brexit position, because, you know, there is a huge and significant difference between the distant, pretty hard Brexit negotiated by Theresa May and something softer, and, you know, if you don't think so, you know, well, clearly you're not employed in, you know, the manufacturing industry. But because they essentially, you know, it was like a, what's your Brexit position? I accept the result.
Yeah.
And the one party, well, the two parties which didn't, for various reasons, the Green Party did not get the boost that I and lots of people in the Green Party expected, and it would have from having Caroline Lucas as its leader, and the Liberal Democrat campaign, well, we've sort of discussed what happened with that many times. So, yeah, I don't know. That I kind of think that the difference is that there is a clear dividing line between both the big two, and the Liberal Democrats look more viable, have come off the back of more successes. Jo Swinson's campaign is not going to detonate at launch in the same way. But equally, the statutory minimum for a campaign is 25 days, and journalists get bored. People don't just vote on Brexit. So I think it will move away to other issues. What do you think?
Yeah. No, I mean, when you look back at the election last time and you try and think of the difference between Labour and Conservatives' Brexit policies, there wasn't that much difference, whereas now there really is quite a big difference between them. So I think that will obviously factor higher in people's decisions than it did last time round. But I do think there will be other concerns too that might come into it that the parties, either party, might not necessarily anticipate. We don't know when the election's going to be, but we're getting towards winter, and the NHS always struggles at winter when people go in with flu and they have, you know, overcrowded beds, particularly with the social care system. Yes, you know, Boris Johnson wants to put more money into it to fix it, but those results are not going to be seen for a very long time. But there will be more focus on them, because those kind of spending commitments will be part of the Conservative manifesto. So we've spoken about this on the podcast before, but, you know, when they're making their ripostes to people asking questions about austerity by saying, oh, but we've promised X billion to this service, you then look at this service and it's falling apart. So there will be more focus on that by virtue of the fact that the Conservatives have made more of a thing of spending commitments. And those, well, particularly the NHS and social care, I think will be high in people's considerations over winter, or the lead up to winter.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, I mean, so case in another set of announcements at this conference, right? So Sajid Javid essentially re-announced Osborne's target to get it to 60% of median earnings, and then announced a very sensible cleaning up measure, which is that essentially when Osborne increased the minimum wage in the way he did, he significantly increased the gap between the wage for under 25s and over it, because only on, which the bigger the gap becomes, the more you start to incentivize, you know, incredibly bad behavior, you know, discrimination towards the old, etc., etc. And Sajid Javid essentially said, we're effectively just going to fix that.
Yeah.
Those 4 years are going to get the wage increase too.
Yeah.
Which makes sense as a cleaning up policy. And, you know, I think actually the median earnings target obviously has been a success. It's increased the amount it's increased the earning powers of the poorest. It obviously has gone nowhere near to replacing lost earnings to cuts to working tax credits and the like. But, you know, it's a good policy. The problem is it just feels nightmarish to me to go into an election in which wages have not yet gone up.
Yeah.
In which you're going, I've done this thing. Their economic position feels so vulnerable to me that I just feel like there are lots of reasons why it might not activate. But yeah, I just do think boredom is quite a underrated force. Like, you see it with the Government of National Unity chat, right?
Mm.
Where, and this may be deeply unfair, but I think one of the reasons why it gets so much purchase, particularly among the broadcasters, is people just prefer to talk about personalities than the chewy policy of, you know, this customs frontier, that customs frontier.
Yeah.
And that is the problem, I think, with anyone saying, oh, it will solely be a Brexit election. Brexit is quite dense and quite dull, and journalists prefer talking about personalities, the NHS, schools, things which are tangible and understandable.
And also things which look good on TV, you know, going around a hospital, as we've seen, actually, to the extreme example with Boris Johnson's recent visit, is good TV footage. Talking about Brexit, it's not easy TV footage.
Yeah.
It's just especially not with Parliament sitting.
Yeah, oh yeah, let's just go to Dover again or whatever. Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And I think that to me is why, although I think Brexit will play a much bigger role, I don't think it will be the only issue by a long chalk. So Anoush, kind of in between the conferences, something which kind of got lost just because of our deadlines and one of the things which we didn't really talk about is Labour's new plans for universal credit. So what are Labour's new plans for universal credit?
Okay, so Labour's new plans for universal credit have been billed as they're scrapping it. But actually, that's not quite true. They are keeping it, they're just heavily reforming it. And essentially, these reforms are clearing up the problems with it that have been most reported by charities that are on the front line, people who use it, etc. The kind of stuff that I've been reporting on for a while. So the main changes they want to make, if you don't mind me whipping through them, are ending the 5-week wait. So universal credit has a 5-week wait for your first payment built into it by design. It used to be longer, but the Conservatives changed it. But they obviously didn't change it enough because people, food bank use is rising because of that wait. What do you do in that 5-week gap if you don't have any savings or you don't have anything else or anyone else to rely on, which is something they, for some reason, didn't really seem to have thought of. They're also going to scrap the benefit cap and the 2-child benefit limit, which is this sort of quite grim policy where you're trying to incentivize people not to have more than 2 children, but that's obviously been proved by history not to be the kind of thing that works, apart from when Ian Duncan Smith announces it to a Conservative Party conference floor. Scrapping the rape clause, which is another particularly tasteless part of universal credit, where you have to prove that you had your child via rape if you want to get benefits for them if you've got more than 2 children.
Scrapping the first scraps the second
by default. Reviewing the sanctions system. So sanctions has been a big problem even before universal credit, sort of these ridiculous standards that you hold claimants to. So I've heard lots of stories. The most recent one from the food bank that I most recently visited was a man was told that he had to go to an interview for a job as a forklift truck driver, even though he didn't have the qualification for it. And he told the job centre person, I'm not qualified to do that job, I won't get it. And they said, you have to do the interview or you won't get X benefit. So he went, and it was a long way away. And he, on his way back, because the interview went on longer than he thought, he missed his next appointment with the job centre, or he was late for it, and he was then sanctioned for 6 months. So, you know, you hear these kind of stories and they are completely bizarre. And so there has to be some kind of reform of the system. And then they want to rename the DWP, the Department for Social Security, to try and make it sound a little bit more like it's actually helping people. They want to try and put it on the same level as the NHS in terms of our sort of national story, something there to help people, something to be fond of, rather than something that's just associated with taking money away from you and punishing you. And they also want to try and change, because universal credit is sort of digital first, and that is a big problem for people who don't have access to computers or the internet or don't have the ability to use them. And there's not enough staff to really support people if they don't have those abilities. So they want to hire more staff and get rid of the digital only sort of premise. So those are all the main changes. And it's actually been a long time running. Labour's been reviewing their welfare policy for a year. And, you know, it's not been an easy ride because universal credit was an idea. It was originally a Labour idea, and it, you know, on paper is a good idea, rolling 6 benefits into one to make it simpler for the user as well as for the government. And the benefit system was extremely complicated beforehand with tax credits as well. So it's an understandable policy. It was born in sort of Labour's last days in government, not days, but, you know, last period in government. Yeah. So it's not necessarily, the system isn't necessarily a bad idea. It's just the way it's being carried out, which is what one of Universal Credit's main architects has been saying recently as well. Really, the big problem is, what do you want universal credit to do? So the Conservatives introduced it partly to save money, but also partly because they wanted to change people's behaviour. Now, what does Labour want universal credit to do? So that's the big question. You know, it doesn't really matter what the system's called. It's what your aim is. And the Labour have said they'll put $3 billion a year into it in order, because they think that's an investment and people will then end up claiming less and less. And so you'll get that money back. That's a behaviour change. How are you going to achieve that? And I think an awful lot outside of the benefit system has to change in order to achieve that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fixes are hugely positive.
Yeah, they are, yeah.
In a way, it's kind of like having spent... So I basically, in some ways, the most arid argument than the existing kind of, you know, from the Liberal Democrats all throughout the Labour Party is basically kind of, do we think universal credit is bad in itself, or do we think it is good but badly underfunded and implemented? And the reason why I think it's a bit arid is whichever one of those premises you start from, you end up with something which looks an awful lot like a fixed universal credit, whether or not your your plan is to go, well, I wouldn't do that, but it's still called universal credit. Or you're like, I'll scrap it and I'll replace it with something, and it's just like, where it's just like, and we'll call it whole credit.
You know, yeah.
And this has, I think, been part of a broader interesting pattern with Labour in the last couple of months. Essentially, where kind of underperforming shadow teams, I think there's been a kind of conscious cleaning up of, like, okay, we're going to have a royal commission, which will basically be about ending the war on drugs. Okay, we will fix these things about universal credit, and we'll look about reforming it sort of later down the line. I think, in a way, the missing part is Labour talks a lot about a national education service. It's still not really clear what it wants that to be beyond parity of esteem for FE.
Yeah.
But I do think part of the kind of missing ingredient here is just how bad we are at upskilling people when they're unemployed, which kind of seems like the obvious thing that universal credit and job centres could... Because the thing on this weird thing, I think if you tie to a child the word job centre, I think their idea of it would perversely be a lot closer to a useful policy.
Yeah, definitely.
Because they'd be like, what? Like, you know, where you like learn about getting a job or get more experience for things. And it's just like, that would be good. But no.
Yeah, no, that's very true. That's a big part of it. And you know, when you've asked lots of the shadow teams about details about their policies, like the National Education Service, like what their new welfare policy is going to be, they haven't really been able to answer the question for a very long time. So I think lots of Labour Party figures will be relieved that they've got a more concrete policy on this now.
Yeah, it kind of... So the other thing, obviously, we haven't had time to talk about this week, although I've written about it in the magazine, of course, is deselection, or actually, to be honest, more accurately, the failure to successfully deselect very many Labour MPs.
Yeah.
There are many reasons why that is bad news for the Corbyn project, but one of them is, at the moment, they have to choose between politically onside and competence a lot of the time.
Yeah.
There are some people who are competent and politically onside, but there are some people who aren't, and ultimately you can't have a successful radical government if you have to make that choice some of the time. You have to have a situation where you can staff your government with people who are onside and competent. And I think it's striking that what's happened in a lot of these policy areas where they've improved, essentially the strong ministers, you know, like the UC stuff, essentially John McDonnell, after watching, you know, two, in my view, underpowered and not very good shadow welfare leaders kind of flop around, essentially came down from on high and went, there's money to fix these things. We'll look at whether or not we want something new, you know, over the course of the office, which to me at least feels like code for hopefully someone will emerge who is better at running this department than what we have at the moment. Although obviously it is important to them in terms of control of the party, I think it is underpriced how much the failure at the moment to remake the parliamentary party is a huge problem for them if they get into government, although of course that if feels quite load-bearing at the moment.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and my colleague Stephen Bush. We're recorded by Emily Bootle and produced by Nick Hilton. And our music is Devil by the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.